Welcome back. This is the third of a five-part series on concepts about SQL Server that all developers should know. I'm Jim O'Neill, a developer evangelist in Microsoft's Northeast District. Let's get started. The sessions in this series stand on their own, so if you didn't catch topics number 5 or 4 yet, no worries, you can view those at your leisure. Those sessions deal with the use of the SQL CLR and recommendations for addressing SQL injection, but right now we're moving on to item number 3, exceptions happen. In this session, I'll classify the types of errors that result from SQL Server interaction and provide suggestions on dealing with them effectively within your application code. Let's start by taking a look at what comprises a SQL error. Here's a representative error message that you might have seen within a SQL Server log or perhaps within an exception you've caught within your code. Each message has a number of properties, the values of which are stored in the SysMessages system table. The error number is a value from 0 to 50,000 for built-in errors, but you can add your own beginning with 50,001 via the SPAddMessage procedure. The severity is a value from 0 to 25 that provides a rough idea of the seriousness of the error, essentially a bunch of bins into which the 8,000-plus messages are partitioned. We'll look at severity in a bit more detail next. The state looks like it would be a valuable piece of information, and it is, but not for normal folks like you and me. The values aren't documented, although people have divined interpretations for various values based on empirical observations. In general, they are values that aid Microsoft support personnel in pinpointing causes of errors, but they aren't of general use, except of course for custom messages that you might create and to which you associate a list of state values that have meaning in your application's domain. Diving a bit deeper, you can think of severity as a continuum to which all error messages, built-in and custom, are mapped. Errors with severity 10 or less are actually considered warnings or informational messages and can often be ignored. One example is a message you get when using an aggregate function like sum in a query where one or more of the values in the sum column are null. Severity 11 to 16 errors are considered fixable by actions you can take within the application generating the error. This might include relatively simple things like a syntax error or more complex scenarios like a deadlock. By the way, note that a deadlock is a severity 13, but a syntax error is a 15. Bottom line, don't read too much into the relationships among the absolute values. So moving on, severities 17 through 19 represent resource issues, like a full transaction log. 20 and higher are big-time errors that terminate the connection and require immediate attention, things like database corruption or media failure. Now, what types of things can cause errors, and how do those errors affect the context of the connection under which they occur? While we just saw that errors are categorized by severity, there's another taxonomy by which we can view errors, namely the four categories you see here. I'm going to step into a demo next using SQL Server Management Studio to demonstrate the effects of these error types. You may be a bit surprised at the outcome. For the samples I'm about to show, I'm using a simple table containing an integer field with a constraint that the value has to be greater than or equal to 0. I'll drop and recreate that table now so we can start with a clean slate. Let's start off with a simple transaction, which tries to insert two values into our table. The first insert should succeed without an error, but the second value is less than 0 and does not obey the constraint we set on that field. When I select the contents of the table after this sequence of statements, what do you think will happen? Well, let's take a look. I get the expected error message, here severity 16, and on the results tab you can see that the value 10 has been inserted. Surprised? Well, this is a statement terminating error in action. Only the insert of the negative 1 failed, not the entire batch. So when the transaction was committed, the actions of successful statements in the batch, like the insert of the value 10, were retained. Here's a variation on the same theme, but here the second statement causes a slightly different error owing to the fact that the table has only one column and I'm providing two values. Execute this batch, and I get another error as expected, also level 16. But look at the results tab. Here the value 11 was not inserted. That's because the error 213, dealing with mismatched columns in the insert, is a batch terminating error, not a statement terminating one. So how do you know the difference? They were both level 16 severity errors. Well, there doesn't appear to be a programmatic way to differentiate them. You just have to know. That, of course, puts the onus on the developer to know what the outcome is going to be for error X versus error Y. To ease that burden, there is a setting called exactAbort that can help. Essentially, exactAbort turns a statement terminating error into a batch terminating one. Here's the same statement terminating scenario, prefaced with the exactAbort setting. When I execute this, the value 14 is not inserted, since the batch is terminated, even though the error itself is a statement terminating one. One thing to keep in mind, though, perhaps more for T-SQL developers than for client developers, is that exact abort does not affect how syntax errors behave, so if encountered, they will not terminate the batch. A third categorization of errors is scope terminating. They are kind of a hybrid, in that they terminate the context in which they are executed, but not necessarily the entire batch. Here's an example. The table foo does not exist, and when I execute this batch, I get the expected error, and the insertion also fails. The scope of the statement is the batch, and that scope is terminated. Now look at the second example. Here I use the exec command for the selection, and when I execute this snippet, the insert succeeds. That's because the scope of the error is confined to the exec command, which fails, but the subsequent insert does not. The last categorization of errors is connection terminating, and the outcome there is pretty clear. I don't have a ready sample here because connection terminating errors are on the upper end of the severity scale, anything greater than or equal to 20, so they spawn from rather extenuating circumstances, like illegal memory access or database engine failures. Now let's head back to the slides. To reiterate what we saw in the demo, exact abort can be an aid to you as a developer in handling errors, eliminating the need to keep track of which errors may roll back a transaction and which may not. In addition to exact abort, though, there are other connection settings, such as those dealing with numeric overflow and ANSI settings, that affect how and if certain errors and warnings are reported. Be sure you understand the interactions of these settings and are aware of what settings your application operates under so that you're doing the right thing programmatically. Next, I want to spend a few minutes on tactics for error handling, both on the server side and the client side. Those of you who have been working with SQL Server for a while are no doubt familiar with the @@error_global variable, which provides the error number for the last statement executed. Although you can be effective using just @@error, it's cumbersome and, no pun intended, error-prone. The value is reset for every statement executed, so it's very easy to inadvertently reset the error, even in code that you are writing specifically to handle the error. SQL Server 2005 introduced try-catch processing, which is very similar, though not quite as complete, as the try-catch-finally clauses that you're familiar with in C#, VB, or Java. In addition to allowing for cleaner error handling code, you gain visibility to more details of the error within the catch block, including the error message, source, and severity. Client-side error handling is something we should all be doing, and generally amounts to catching SQL exceptions whenever we exercise ADO.NET or other database-centric operations. For example, here's a statement that will cause a divide by zero exception. So if we were to execute this in a VB or C# program via a standard ADO.NET mechanism, we'd get the expected SQL exception. Likewise, we'd get the same exception if we went through link to SQL and executed this statement as part of a link query. But note what happens with the Entity Framework, which is an object relational mapping tool, like Link2SQL, but with broader capabilities and reach. Here the exception that the client receives is an abstracted Entity Command Execution exception. It does retain the SQL exception as an inner exception, but if your client code were only expecting SQL exceptions, the Entity Framework scenario would not be appropriately handled. So keep that in mind as you use tools and frameworks like Entity Framework or nHibernate to abstract the database access. On the client, you can also trap and handle warning conditions. Remember, these are messages with severity 10 or less. You do this by creating an event delegate and accessing the warning conditions via the errors collection of the event argument class. Let's wrap this up as I do for other sessions in this series, with a list of do's and don'ts. If you aren't already, use the try-catch mechanism within your T-SQL constructs in lieu of @@error. And if you have the opportunity, use exact abort to save the effort of having to distinguish statement terminating from batch terminating errors, but also be aware of other connection settings that affect how errors and warnings may be reported and logged. As we saw from the demo, don't assume that an error implies a rollback, or use exact abort so you can assume that. The next one should go without saying, but don't use try-catch as a crutch. If an error occurs, don't just swallow it and move on. Get to the root cause and fix it when practical. Lastly, and this may seem like a trivial one, if you are using custom errors, don't start at the first number available, namely 50,001. Custom errors apply server-wide, so if another in-house or third-party application uses custom messages, there's a potential for those messages to conflict. Starting with some off-the-wall value, you have 2.1 billion numbers available, after all, lessens the likelihood of a conflict. That's it for this session. I hope you found it useful, and we'll catch the others in the series. Thanks, and have a great day.